I think we'll get started just about now. So I want to thank everyone for coming today, including researchers and admin staff from Perimeter Institute and IQC. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Lisa Lombau with Perimeter's External Relations team, and it's our pleasure to have the opportunity to share science communication related talks with you from time to time. You may have attended some of our talks in past years, such as the one we had Ivan Semenuk present, which I'll touch on a little bit later, dealing with a journalist's perspective on science media. Today's theme involves the shaping of your message for intended audiences and not just the media. I'm happy to present David Harris, who's a theoretical physicist turned science communicator, who has been thinking about ways to craft specific messages, whether for a paper, a presentation, or for outreach and other science communication purposes. David is a journalist who has worked internationally in print, radio, television, and online. He was the founding editor-in-chief of Symmetry Magazine, a particle physics publication, and recently started up the front magazine section of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America. He has also been head of media relations for the American Physical Society and has served as deputy director of communications at SLAC National Accelerator Center. He is actively exploring new frontiers in science communication, from using design thinking to help shape messages to leveraging online tools for sharing research-related content with science enthusiasts. Please welcome David Harris.
Thank you, Lisa. It's a pleasure to be here at Perimeter. I've followed closely the development of the Institute over its lifetime, but unfortunately never had a chance to come until now. So I appreciate the opportunity to come here and visit and speak with all of you. Today I want to speak about how to do better science communication using design thinking. This isn't a talk about graphics and about graphic design. I'll just make that clear right at the beginning, but I'll explain what we're going to go through today over the next minute or so. Because this is a theoretical physics institute, I thought I'd better start with some theory. And so there are a few topics that we'll cover there and follow that up with some applications of that theory to more practical situations that you might encounter when you're communicating science, whether as a scientist or as a science outreach person or whatever form of scientific communication that you're interested in. But first, a little context. I'd like to start by talking about how most science communication projects are conducted by scientists. They typically go through a series of about 5 steps, and it starts with having a great idea of something to do. People say, wouldn't it be great if I gave a public lecture on this new piece of research, or wouldn't it be great if I wrote a book on something, or designed a project for kids in schools, or made a video, or whatever it was, and they worked out what they wanted to do. Then find the resources to make it happen. Of course, after the great idea, you need to make some practical progress. Prepare for the project, prepare for actually making it happen and getting it out there in front of an audience, and then find an audience. And this is, unfortunately, a way that a lot of science communication happens. The concern about the audience happens really late in the process. Those of you who are science communicators by profession know that finding an audience is one of the earlier things that you should be doing, but in practice, as most scientists do SciComm projects, it comes fairly late. And then you actually execute the project, do it for an audience. So this is generally a pretty linear process. People follow these steps typically in this order. This is just by observation, but is it an optimal approach? And we're going to talk a bit about this today and discover that it's not really. But to begin with, I'd like to cover a few definitions and talk about what design is. And you can talk about design in as many ways as there are people to talk about design. There is no one definition of it, but these are some definitions and some aspects of what design is according to various people. It's a synthesis of form and content. It's also a process for solving problems. Design, interestingly, is a general field that doesn't have a particular subject matter. Design as a process can be applied to just about any subject matter, including science. And it's part art and part science. There's a certain amount of research that has gone into what makes for good design and good communication, but not a lot of it. And so there's still very much a degree of art and craft to making it happen. Graphic design It's just one type of design. It's a subfield of design concerning the application of general design principles to communication, and typically involves layout and typography and imagery, the sorts of things that you're used to. But it's just one subfield of design, and we will talk a little about graphic design in the next hour, but won't be concentrating on it as much as the idea of process and what that can mean for us. Design thinking, in particular, is the name given to the process plus a set of modes of thinking. And that's really what we want to explore today and see what that, how that's different from, say, a scientific method or some other ad hoc approaches to solving problems. All strategic science communication problems should have some sort of goal. You don't just do it on a whim, typically, well, some people do, but if you're doing it strategically, there's some purpose to why you're doing it. But because it has a goal, it's something that you can phrase as a problem to be solved. And so we want some way to tackle these kinds of problems in a systematic way. So the kinds of problems that you might be talking about are convincing an audience of the validity of some science. There might be some persuasion. You might just want to teach some concepts in science. You might want to increase awareness of science or increase enthusiasm or support for science if you're talking to funding audiences, governments, that sort of thing, or influencers. What sort of problems are there? I'm going to present a simple classification of problems. And the first is simple problems, where both the problem and the solution are known. So an example from theoretical physics is the eigenstates of a quantum system, which is a simple problem. You can just crank it through, and you can check whether the answers you've developed are right or not, theoretically, not too much to worry about. A complex problem is one where the problems are known, that the problem is known, but the solution is not known. And the example I give here is predicting masses of new particles from a parameterized particle physics theory. So you won't know whether or not you've got the right solution until you do a bunch of experiments, or someone else does a bunch of experiments to confirm what your theory is predicting. And if it's something like a parameterized particle physics theory, you don't know, might not know how to pin down those parameters, so you really need that experimental guidance to work out what the solution actually is. And then there's a class called wicked problems. And this is where the problem is not well defined and the solution is not known. And from theoretical physics, I'd say the best idea is quantum gravity as a problem. Of course, you can define specific problems better within quantum gravity, but overall, just the field of quantum gravity is a problem to be solved. But it's not yet well defined. We don't know how to test it really yet. And I think it fits in the category of wicked problems. This is a list of how you know you're facing a wicked problem. And this was originally applied to planning an architecture by a mathematician turned designer called Horst Rittel. And I'll just let you read these points. I'm going to make the slides available to you afterwards, so I won't read them all out at the moment. But you can see why these problems tend to be called wicked. It's really hard to work out if you've got a solution and whether or not that solution might be right. In many cases, a wicked problem is unique. You don't have a lot of experience to draw on, or you're doing it for a particular case which you haven't encountered before, so in communications for a particular audience that you might not have been in front of, or with unique characteristics. And so there's not generally a lot of room for trial and error in what you do. That's not to say you can't prepare for one of these things, and that's part of what we're going to get to in design thinking. But what I'd like to claim is that communication is a wicked problem. And the reason is that the science of science communication is very much in its infancy, and we don't have a lot of results to go on. It is an active research field, the science of science communication, but people don't know all that much just yet. So what are some wicked problems in science communication? Well, I think giving a public lecture is, writing a popular science book, making a video, creating a science game. I think these are all actually wicked problems because it's not clear what the solution is when you start. The problem isn't well defined generally. You have to come up with some somewhat arbitrary definition of the problem to come up with any solution, and how you change that definition can drastically change how you change the the question can drastically change what sort of solution you come up with. And I think this is a nice quote from a famous designer, Paul Rand, who did things like the IBM logo and the Westinghouse logo, and has been known as one of the great typographers and graphic designers of the 20th century. Design is combining form and content, as we saw before. We need both. Too much form becomes abstract, and too much content becomes unreadable. Here's another quote about design, and it says that they're indeterminate or wicked because design has no subject matter of its own apart from what a designer conceives it to be. So in many cases, the world is your oyster, and you're going to draw on whatever part of the universe you feel inclined to try and solve a problem. But when you do it, a designer will typically encounter very different fields of thinking and different subject matter from time to time. When we do science communication, the content is always changing, the audiences are always changing, and so we need some more general techniques to get through these sorts of problems. Part of the reasons I say a communication problem is a design problem is that you have your subject content, but you also have to bring in things from psychology and sociology and rhetoric and a bunch of other fields to do it effectively. What about models of science communication? Just how can we go about doing it? Ideally, we'd use data. We're scientists, and we want to use data to drive what we do. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, the science of science communication is very young, and we don't have a lot to go on. So let's instead think about what sort of models there are. The most common way people do science communication is just an ad hoc method. It's similar to what I described at the beginning. They come up with some great idea, they find some resources to do it, then they scramble around to work out who is going to like this thing that they just created, and it's not strategic. These approaches tend to neglect best practice and the evidence about what works and what doesn't in science communication where we know it. What about another model for science communication? This is called the information deficit model. And this is a model that assumes that conveying information will bring an audience on side. And it's the model that is most often used, often not knowingly. It's just the natural approach that people use when they're talking to governments about funding, about within their institution, about getting support, a bunch of other places. Unfortunately, there are some real problems with it, and we'll come back to that in just a moment. What about the scientific method for solving problems in communication? Challenge is that it assumes a well-defined problem with a testable solution and the evidence, and we often don't have that. I'd say that some science education problems are amenable to the scientific method, and there's a lot of research that goes on in science education. It's a fairly well-established field, and you can deal with a lot of it scientifically. So what are we going to use for these ill-defined problems with many factors and fuzzy solutions? Something called design thinking, which I'm about to outline for you. But just want to go back to this deficit model again, because it's so pernicious and pervasive. This is what the deficit model is. It attributes public skepticism or hostility to a lack of understanding resulting from a lack of information. So people think, give more information and people will understand science better, they'll support what we're doing, and we'll be fine. For a long time, this is the approach that people have used. And it implies that communication should focus on transferring information from experts to lay audiences. Very much a one-way process, and assuming that information is enough. The trouble is, it's communicator-centered. It's centered around the person doing the communicating and doesn't take into account the characteristics and needs of the audiences, particularly. It's also widely discredited as not reflective of reality, and there's a lot of research that shows it just doesn't work. And some examples of where it has failed in society, where it's been tried for years and years and failed, are some of these. Global warming, mad cow disease, genetically modified foods in particular, anything to do with nuclear, political support for basic research, and the superconducting supercollider, of course, something that still pains many of us in the field. Let's talk about design for a moment, and we'll get on to then the stages of design thinking. But first, what design isn't. I just found this interesting quote from a designer. So you'll have to forgive the lack of scientific accuracy, but I think it illustrates an important point. When Einstein realized, dear me, this universe with its wonders all adds up to E equals mc squared, he did not stop to think whether this concept would sell better set in the fonts Futura or Antiqua. And that's very true. You can't get anywhere without good content to start with. Design and graphic design won't solve all your problems. But we're not just talking about presentation here. We're going to be talking about a process. By the way, for the sticklers in the audience, that is Futura, that's not Antiqua. I don't have the typeface, and I don't actually know what it looks like, to be honest. But what about what design is? As we mentioned before, it's a method of putting form and content together. It's got multiple definitions, so it's problematic. It can be aesthetics. And Paul Rand says it's so simple, that's why it's so complicated. But what about a more formal definition? Academics in design theory have looked at this problem and defined design as a specification of an object, where an object is meant in the philosophical sense, not necessarily a physical thing that you can hold in your hands. The object could be a strategy or a blueprint, or it could be a physical object, manifested by some agent, intended to accomplish goals in a particular environment, using a set of primitive components, satisfying a set of requirements, subject to some constraints. There are a lot of parts that come into this, a lot of interacting and moving parts in a design problem. I don't want to unpack this in any detail, but point out, if we try to define theoretical physics in the same sorts of terms, what does it look like? Well, we miss many of these points, because we don't care when we do theoretical physics who is doing the theory or who is reading the results of that theoretical physics exploration. We don't care about the environment that it's done in. Physics is the same everywhere. It's fundamental. We do still have a set of primitive components, generally mathematical components and conceptual components. And we're subject to various constraints, which sometimes is reality and empirical evidence. Of course, there's some theory we do that we know doesn't match reality, and it's still important to do for various reasons. But there are always some constraints of fitting in with previous theories or whatever you have. Science and design seem like pretty different things to start with. And we illustrate this with another quote. The scientific method is a pattern of problem-solving behavior employed in finding out the nature of what exists, whereas the design method is a pattern of behavior employed in inventing things of value which do not yet exist. So science is analytic and design is constructive. The natural sciences are concerned with how things are. Design, on the other hand, is concerned with how things ought to be. Again, another conflict between the nature of science and the nature of design. And we've got a quote here, which I won't read out in detail, but it talks about one of the reasons why scientists and designers have so many problems communicating with each other. The languages are very different, and they study very different types of problems. The context, the content of scientific theory is pretty well defined, whereas designers aren't used to that. In fact, some design theorists have gone as far as proposing there are three cultures in the world. We've all heard of C.P. Snow's two cultures of science and humanities, but some designers claim there are in fact three cultures. So where science is concerned with the natural world, humanities concerned with human experience, design is concerned with the artificial world. And you can see some other contrasts in the methods and the values of science, humanities, and design. In particular, in that list, there was analysis as scientific and synthesis under the design column. Analysis has these properties: rational, logical, deductive. There are solutions. You think it through. It's a single discipline. And elegance is desired. Whereas for synthesis, it tends to be more emotional, intuitive, inductive. You're talking about paradigms and platforms. You think by doing, and we're going to come back to that concept quite a bit, involves multiple disciplines, and what you care about in the end is impact. So design thinking itself. what does it look like? I'm going to come around to say that although science and design, just to give away the ending, the science and design seem very different and at odds, but in fact, science communication fits much closer to design than it does to science, and there actually is more overlap than you think. But let's talk about now a process that you can actually use to effectively communicate science. Of course, we have our friend Mr. Popper warning us that there's no way you can have a process that will lead to a logical reconstruction of process. So we're going to go against Karl Popper's advice and try and outline some sort of process with some steps. But this really serves as a warning to us to keep in mind that you can't perfectly write down this process. There's always going to be some wiggle room and some differences, and you'll have to modify it at times. Two variants I'll show you of design thinking. One has seven steps. Define, and I'll go through these. Define, research, ideate, prototype, choose, implement, and learn. And so you can find this easily. It turns out this is the version of design thinking that you'll find on Wikipedia. So you can look this up later if you forget the steps. You don't need to take notes. Another variant comes from the Stanford, the Hasso-Plattner School of Design, or the D School, as it's known at Stanford, which uses empathize, define, ideate, prototype, and test. They're mostly equivalent with some different names for things and a few things bundled together in different ways. But I'm going to go through one of them. But at the beginning, I said that design thinking was not just about a process, but also a set of modes of thinking. And this is quite important to how we approach these problems. We're going to focus on things like showing, not telling. You want to focus on human values, craft clarity, embrace experimentation, have a be mindful of process, a bias toward action, I'll explain. That means you don't want to just sit and think things through. You want to actually do stuff, make real stuff appear in the world as part of your process to solving problems. And of course, radical collaboration means that you want to bring in people who you wouldn't normally expect to. So for communicators, it means don't just bring in other professional science communicators, or don't just bring in the scientists. Go a little bit beyond that. What does this mean for communicating theoretical physics? Suppose you want to convey some emerging concept. You've just done some research, and you've got some great ideas, and you want to get it out there in the world. How do you apply these steps to solving the problem of conveying these concepts? First, you need to decide what issue you're trying to resolve, so convey the excitement of an emerging concept in theoretical physics. Work out the audience at the beginning. In this case, we might choose the science-interested general public. You want to determine what will make the project successful. You establish a glossary of terms, or at least figure out what the audience knows and doesn't know in terms of jargon, so that you can deal with that when you actually communicate. The next step is research. In a design process, you'll generally go through the history of this sort of problem and find out what's gone on. So, for example, there's a long history of public lectures to fall back on and to learn from. And we know from that experience some things that work and some things that don't. We want to think about that. We want to collect examples of other attempts to solve the problem. So did you have do you have a public lecture? Do you write a popular book? There are a myriad ways of actually doing this communication. You want to collect together a bunch of examples to think about it. Work out who your supporters, investors, and critics are. And then start talking to your end users. You want to start talking to members of the audience that you hope to engage with your science communication effort quite early on. It's not just the audience that defines what you want to do. You can't only cater to the needs of a large crowd, because that tends to water things down over time. You also want to get the opinions of experts and thought leaders. So in the case of science communication, talk to a public information officer. Talk to the communications and outreach and media officers here at Perimeter if you're doing a project. They have expertise in doing this that will be useful. When you talk to the users, you need to work out what their needs and motivations are. Now, if you're talking with a general public audience, the motivation for most of them is simply going to be entertainment. Most of them are not professional physicists that will need to use the research that you're doing. So you need to recall at all times that it is about entertainment, even though that doesn't seem like a very serious or noble cause. It's what you need to remember. So you generate your ideas, whether it's a lecture, a book, or a bus advertisement. Now, you shouldn't laugh necessarily at the bus advertisement yet, because it might turn out to be just the right solution that you need. You need to go through a brainstorming session and make sure you pin down all the possibilities. And then you start to create something. You bring something into the world, whether it's sketches or outlines, and you present these ideas to members of your audience and get feedback at this early stage. You don't have to have a finished, polished product to show people. It's better not to. It's better to show something in draft form and let people know it's in draft form and have them understand what you're trying to do. You need to eventually choose what you're going to do. Choose what your content will be, your format, how you're going to approach the problem, then you start to implement it in the ways that you can imagine. And finally, you want to learn from it, get some feedback, and work out if you've been successful in what you've done. So these are the sorts of steps that you might go through, and I might seem like I'm laboring the point, but this is different to how most people do science communication. Yet this has also been shown to be extremely effective, and I think it's very useful to have a framework for how you can communicate science, just to help you along the way, particularly if you're not used to it. After a while of doing this, you tend to internalize a lot of these ideas, but it can take some time. One nice quote that I came across when you're talking about prototyping and starting to get things out in the world, you prototype as if you know you're right, but then test as if you know you're wrong. So you want to separate these two phases, and this can be a useful framework. To work out what I wanted to present today, I went through a design thinking process. So the idea of this talk was to encourage theoretical physicists to consider this framework for developing science communication projects. I looked for previous work on science communication and design, and there's very little in this area, as it turns out. I thought, should I present slides? Should there be handouts? Should I be instead writing an essay, presenting a video? One of the constraints that I had was that I'd been invited to come and speak with you, so it ended up being a lecture or colloquium in this form. But then I started to prototype. I drafted an abstract, and I started to show it to various people who were in the audience, and I refined the abstract and went through 6 or 7 variations till it was testing well with audiences. I outlined the slides and tested them with audiences, and I'll show you at the end just who I have to thank for responding to those tests to see what we've got here. Had to choose what content to cover, what order to do it. I'm up to implement right now because I'm giving the colloquium, and at the end I'm very happy to hear any feedback or learn more from you about what we've talked about. But what were some concerns I had about doing this? I wanted to know what it would look like. Should it all be text or should it be images? And I thought, well, theoretical physicists are actually used to text-only presentations, so I'm not going to push them too far out of their comfort zone. So I'm going to stick with pretty much a text-only presentation, and that comes from one of the mindsets of know your audience. Should it be purely examples or more theoretical? I decided to go for a more theoretical framework based on who we've got in the audience. What structure should I use? I could just build a lot of models and build up to a conclusion at the end and say, ta-da, this is what we get to, which is what theoretical physicists are used to in presentations. But we also have to bring in the human side earlier and understand that we need to have a focus on science communication earlier in the talk as well, so you wouldn't just think it was all strange design theory. Should I do the whole thing in LaTeX as the slides? It's what theoretical physicists are used to seeing. Should I use quotes? They're not scientific evidence, but they show something about design rather than just telling you about design. I used a bunch of different people to look at it, worked out what the take-home messages should be, and had to ask myself, will this fail catastrophically? this is a very different kind of presentation to give in front of this kind of audience. And so I felt I was taking a real risk in doing it. And so we'll see whether or not this is useful to you at the end. But I'm hoping that there are at least a few nuggets that are of value to you. A sidestep into design and theoretical physics for a moment. How is theoretical physics actually like design, the design process? Instead of the defined step of design thinking, you're generally choosing a scope or a question to answer. Your research tends to be a literature review, discussions with other scientists. When you ideate, that's formation of hypotheses. Your prototyping tends to be model building, conducting seminars, chatting with other people. You're actually creating some sort of output from your conceptual ideas and starting to put them out into the world and getting feedback on them. You need to actually nail down those models into some sort of theory, which you typically do by looking at what some of the predictions of the theory are. And the implementation of this design process is to actually write up the paper at the end. Now, of course, this isn't a strictly linear process. You jump back and forth through it. In design thinking, you tend to jump back and forth through some of these steps. When you do theoretical physics, you jump back and forth through many of these steps. Oh, and of course, you learn by listening to your colleagues' responses. So why do we want to use a design methodology for communication? Just to review, empathy with your audience is absolutely necessary. You need to understand where they're coming from. It turns out that prototyping and testing is more powerful than deduction when it comes to communication problems. And it helps to avoid a complete failure. There are many cases where people have designed some sort of science communication program and put it out into the world, and they've spent a lot of money and time working on it, and then just no one cares, and no one is interested, they don't get any audience, and it's been a big waste of time. One way to avoid that is to start testing early and often. Also, having this methodology and this framework explicit makes it a bit easier to follow successfully. And the other thing is it allows for intuition in the process, where we're doing something that isn't guided entirely by evidence. So we need to use our gut feelings at times and our experience. So it's a process that allows you to build all of that in. What lessons and examples can we draw for theoretical physics when they're communicating science? One of the most important is to employ beginner's mind. You need to empathize with your audience and understand where your audience is coming from. And remember that they haven't had all the years of training that you've had. They're not comfortable with mathematics in many cases. And you need to go back and think, what was it like when I was learning about this? And to do that for a theoretical physicist, it probably means you need to go back to middle school, to what you imagine you knew in middle school, to get what the average graduate knows, because we all misremember just how much we've learned at certain times. You need to go way, way, way back. Entertaining stories work very effectively for communicating science. Don't just think about what you're doing. Create something. Create prototypes and examples and test them. Test them often. Drafts and feedback are definitely your friend. Use pilot projects if you're doing something. Just present to a smaller audience and see how it goes. And of course, work with people from surprising fields. And you'll be amazed at what sort of difference that can make to your communication products, because you'll really start to understand what assumptions you've made about the knowledge of your audience. So what does this mean in practice? Let's talk about the Higgs mechanism explanation. So we'll get into some more detailed applications to theoretical physics. The typical Higgs explanation has two phases to it. One says, well, first, the standard model tells us that particles don't have any mass. And then you tell some other story, generally through an analogy, about how the mass comes about, which seems entirely reasonable to a theoretical physicist to tell the story in this way. But it misses the point of beginner's mind entirely. Because beginners don't see why we should start from no mass when we're telling this story. They're used to there being mass in the world. Why would you suddenly have to assume something that isn't real or that isn't reality just to get back to what we already know? And it's a confusing process. But just about all the explanations of the Higgs mechanisms you see follow this pattern. And I'm not at all convinced that they're effective for lay audiences. Special relativity is often easier to deal with, but your explanations assume Galilean relativity to begin with, but people don't get frame changes. They have trouble imagining in the thought experiment that they're on a train and the train is vibrating. They feel like they know they're moving, and they have trouble imagining that they're still and the rest of the world is coming by. They still somehow inherently, they know that they're the one moving. It means that you can't just do a basic concept of changing a reference frame for a lay audience necessarily without making some assumptions about what they know or without confusing them. So whenever you're trying to get a person from starting at one point in their thinking to somewhere else, which is how most explanations work, you need to make sure you're really at the right place to begin with. And it's probably the most common flaw in science communication, that people don't start at the right place. Thought experiments are used, and they can be very powerful. It's a good thing to do. They're in the form of stories, typically, so that's great. They show rather than tell. They can be a lot better than analogies, because analogies can really mess up a beginner in various ways, just because they take the analogy too far in one direction, and that then confuses them. You know, the idea of electricity as a fluid is an analogy that's often used in talking about currents and voltages and all different aspects of electricity. But it leads to crazy situations, like, for example, where I met a woman who insisted on keeping things plugged into the power outlets in the wall, or else the electricity would flow out onto the floor and electrocute her. It all comes from this mistaken analogy. And you never know what sorts of analogies like that are going to come about, what sort of breaks they'll have. So you have to start where the audience is. And ideally, you'll prototype and test these stories. Try them out on your spouse or partner. Try them out on your friends who aren't scientists, who come from completely different fields. There's a quote here that's from a very famous lecture, the Crystal Goblet Lecture, that was given to the British Typographers Guild in 1955 by Beatrice Ward. And I will just read this. "You have two goblets before you. One is solid gold wrought in the most exquisite patterns. The other is of crystal clear glass, thin as a bubble and as transparent. Pour and drink, and according to your choice of goblet, I shall know whether or not you're a connoisseur of wine. For if you have no feelings about wine one way or the other, you'll want the sensation of drinking the stuff out of a vessel that may have cost thousands of pounds. But if you're a member of that vanishing tribe, the amateurs of fine vintages, you'll choose the crystal, because everything about it is calculated to reveal rather than to hide the beautiful thing which it was meant to contain." This is written in the context of typography, so that the typography shouldn't be a distraction from the content. And it's an important lesson for when we communicate science as well. Design, of course, is form and content, and for most of our purposes, the form should be pretty much invisible. We want the content to shine. We want it to be delivered in a crystal goblet. There are times when it might warrant some more extravagant form if you have a particular audience, if you have a particularly young audience that's used to a lot more graphic design of things. You might want to jazz things up a bit. If I were talking to a design audience, I would have put together a very different presentation, because this wouldn't be invisible to them. All this text would be a problem for them to read, because it's not what they're used to. But generally, you want the form to be invisible. What about this case, the Higgs announcement and Comic Sans? There was a lot of talk that maybe it should be renamed Comic CERN. There's a petition out there somewhere to rename the typeface. These are the kinds of slides, and it doesn't matter that you can't see it, but all that text is in Comic Sans, and whatever you feel about Comic Sans, a lot of people in the world hated it and said, this is ridiculous. These people are doing some of the most sophisticated experiments in the world, and yet they're looking amateurish by using this particular typeface. Fabiola got a lot of heat for this. There are a large number of interviews after the fact where people said, why did you use Comic Sans? And she basically said, well, I like it and it's friendly. But another fact is that she's used to it. She's not the only particle physicist who gives presentations in Comic Sans. There are lots of them. So much so that it's practically invisible. And so it's not necessarily a problem for an audience of particle physicists that it's in Comic Sans, because they're just used to it. The problem with the talks was that there was such a high density of information on the slides. Now, that in itself wasn't a problem for the physicists in the audience. They're used to that also. But this is a presentation that was going out to the wide world, and I don't think that either of the presenters on that Higgs announcement day gave that a lot of thought. Of course, they felt that they were giving a scientific seminar to their colleagues, but I also feel that they could have known that this is going to be viewed a lot more broadly and could have done a better job at presenting this in a way that's friendly to the audience. As far as particle physicists go, the presentations were fine. They were very dense, and they used Comic Sans, but it didn't matter for that audience. That was all invisible. For the public audiences, it mattered a great deal. When I did Symmetry magazine, we thought a lot about this, and in many cases, we made the form a lot more visible. Symmetry magazine was a particle physics magazine of which I was the founding editor-in-chief, pushing 10 years ago now. It came out of Fermilab and SLAC, National Accelerator Lab. And it was a very colorful magazine with a lot of design. Because our goals were impressionistic, we were trying to get to an audience that wouldn't necessarily read a lot of details about particle physics, but we wanted to leave behind an impression of what the field of particle physics was like, just from picking up and flicking through the magazine. So we needed the form to be doing a lot of the talking for us, not just the words. But our philosophy for the graphic design, and in fact the rest of the design process when we did this, was to embody a set of adjectives, and we based this on talking to our audiences very early in the process. We had some focus groups, we talked with members of the prospective audience, and came up with, for example, this set of adjectives. We wanted the magazine to appear clean, approachable, artful and stylish, I've got approachable twice, sorry, alive, novel, engaging and credible. These were all things that we heard were desirable from our test audiences, or that we needed to do to create the kind of impression that we wanted to create. And we stuck by these adjectives for a very long time and always kept them in mind as we went through this process. Let's take a sidestep to what does design thinking mean for writing scientific papers. The paper could be the implement stage of a design process. When I talked about how theoretical physics was like design, there was the implement stage and it said, write the paper. But beyond that, you could apply the whole design thinking process just to the paper if you want. So you need to start with your audience, ask questions like, is it within the field, within your specialty subfield that you're writing for, or is it broader? Maybe it's a review paper. Maybe it's a paper that you want to be read by newcomers to the field. So you need to know your audience, even when it's a scientific paper. You need to know your constraints, so make sure you get the journal format right. You need to work out what the story of the paper is. And this is what is missing from so many scientific papers, and I think distinguishes many good papers from bad papers. There's a sense of story in the scientific paper. And there are some authors who are just fantastic at writing these kinds of papers that really tell you a story and guide you through the process, and other people just want to write down a lot of equations and not really link it together in a useful way and don't help guide you through whatever the paper is telling you. What else should you do? You should use outlines to draft the paper, and many of you probably do, but you should think about sharing those outlines with colleagues. That's not something that is typically done. But why not, early on in the process, start checking whether or not this is going to be effective before you put in all the effort later on. And also share drafts with your colleagues for feedback. Many people do that, but they don't share widely enough. You wouldn't believe the value you can get in writing a good scientific paper by sharing it with some undergraduate students. They don't know the details of the field, but you're supposed to be explaining to someone who doesn't already know the field. That's the point of the paper, This is someone who doesn't already know what you're presenting. So the perspective of someone who really is a beginner to this, but might have some interest in it, is invaluable. What this implies, though, is that you need to think about a semi-open process for doing your research. You need to start showing what you're doing earlier on than you're used to. It doesn't really work if you're going to be very secretive about everything that you're doing and finally come out with a paper at the end. And I would actually encourage what's sometimes called open notebook science, where people do research almost in public, and I find it really interesting being in this building here at Perimeter, that a large part of the process of doing science is in public. In all these common areas with blackboards, it's science happening in front of an audience. But also, you can look in from outside the building, from over by the lake, look into the building and see these common areas, and you can see physicists at work. I would advocate going even a step further to sharing more of your ideas even more broadly, because there are people out there who can give you feedback that you won't expect but could be useful. How you do this, it could be a research blog. You could actually be showing things from your notebook literally. There are a number of approaches, but if you start to share early, you'd be amazed at what sort of feedback you can get. So let me finish off with a few thoughts. In a nutshell, what I'm saying is that because we don't have strong codified evidence for what works in science communication, we need something in the process to make up for that lack. And design thinking is one approach that's proven to be effective in solving wicked problems. So what I really want you to take away from this is the idea that you can use a process to help guide you when you're doing science communication. And the kind of steps that it involves are the ones that I've outlined today. So some advice. Get advice from knowledgeable people. Remember the communications and outreach and media offices here at Perimeter. They're your friend. They will help you out with all kinds of different things. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. When you do your research phase of the project, find out what already exists and make sure you take advantage of what is already there. Be part of the remix culture that is growing in the internet age. But also invent new wheels. You want to do something creative. You don't just have to follow what everyone else has been doing. Try something different. I think that it can be extremely valuable to collaborate with designers who come at this from a very different mindset and a different way of thinking. Consider semi-open notebook research, as I talked about. And finally, as one of the really key messages, prototype and test more than you think you need to. I just can't emphasize that enough. When I said I collaborated with a number of people in preparing this presentation, that's a list of the people and what they do. I mean, one that kind of stands out is actually my wife is on that list as a criminologist. But, you know, she brought a very different perspective to what was going on, and I made considerable changes to what I was going to do based on her feedback. But I heard from particle physicists and astrophysicists and expert science communicators and designers, and some of the theoretical physicists here at Perimeter gave feedback on the abstract at the beginning, and we tweaked things as we went along. I'll leave you with a couple of quotes. So Ernest Rutherford said, "A well-constructed theory is in some respects undoubtedly an artistic production. And remember that what we're doing in science communication as a form of design is a synthesis of form and content. And we want the content to shine where the form is there to help us really get the content across. This process will help us connect the form and the content together in a useful way." That's what I have for you today. I think Lisa is going to talk to us for a minute, and then we'll take some questions.
Since we're on the subject of science communication, I just wanted to dive into something before we get to Q&A with David. I want to take a moment to share opportunities for science communication right here at Perimeter. And we have a number of them. So just want to touch on briefly how you can get involved with educational outreach, publications, or external relations here at Perimeter. With respect to educational outreach, you may have heard of our upcoming festival, BrainSTEM, Your Future Is Now. It's running from September 30th until October 6th. And there's a number of ways to get involved. The point of the festival is to try and inspire discovery, innovation, and imagination. Some of the programming involved will include hands-on exhibits right here in our atrium, Physica Fantasticas, webcasted public lectures, science comedy in the club, which should be a lot of fun, and building tours of Perimeter. So if you'd like to get involved with that, some opportunities specifically include our Ask a Scientist session. So some of you may have participated in this when we did the grand opening of the Stephen Hawking Center, but it provides an opportunity to interact with high school students and members of the general public and discuss what sparks your passion for science and what you're currently working on. There's also opportunities to be an exhibit host or an exhibit guide and discuss the science of quantum dots, of black holes, of refraction, and other scientific topics as well. And then for admin staff or family and friends, there's some non-scientific opportunities as well, whether it's to welcome students, do line control, be a directional guide, and offer help with ticketing. So if you're interested in any of those aspects, or if you want to get some more information, talk to Marie Strickland in our outreach department. I'm not sure if she's here right now. Maybe not, but this is the contact information for Marie, so feel free to touch base with her or any member of the outreach team. With respect to our wonderful publications, you've probably seen our beautiful magazine that's you can find around at the front desk or over in the bistro and on some other tables around, as well as our website. If you're interested in either sharing your story or being a part of a story in one of those outlets, Natasha Waxman is the contact for that. Here's her information here, or there's Mike and Aaron and Phil as well, who you could reach out to get involved that way. And finally, with respect to external relations, we're here to support your engagement with the media, so whether that's building relationships with reporters, understanding the nature of media requests and the expectations with them, preparing for your interviews, or getting your message across, please reach out to us. We're here to help on that. And also on that front, I made reference to it sooner, I just want to remind you, Ivan Semenuk, who was formerly the U.S. Chief of Correspondence for Nature and is now the science reporter at the Globe and Mail. We were privileged enough to have him here last year for our science communication colloquium, and you can find that talk there. And it's really informative of giving a journalist perspective on science media. And again, for any kind of media-related science communication inquiries, you can contact John Matlock, who's the Director of External Relations and Public Affairs, or you can reach out to myself. And on that, I want to throw things back to David. So we have some time right now for questions and answers. I just want to remind you that this session is being recorded for PIRSA. So I've got Ann Little on this side of the theater. I'll be on this side, and we've got portable microphones. So if you just want to put your hand up, we'll bring the microphone to you, and David will be able to answer your questions for you.
Thank you. I'm not sure if you'll actually be able to give an obvious and clear answer to this, but it's just something that I would like to hear your thoughts on.
Yeah.
So I work in science communications here at Perimeter. I'm one of the writers for the Institute. And I'm wondering, with your explanation of how the Higgs discovery was communicated, there was a lot of talk about how there had to be a frame shift from Galileo to special relativity. I'm wondering, all these things that are uncomfortable for people to do When physics is such a big body of knowledge, all this, standing on the shoulders of giants, is there a point at which we actually just can't communicate anymore with the general public? Is there a point of diminishing returns when we have to change the science so completely in explaining it that it isn't even really what it ought to be anymore? Or is there always going to be a perfect way to design an explanation?
Right. I think it's a good question, and I think there's a lot of debate among science communicators what the answer to this is. If you've got enough time and a person who'll bear with you for the time, I think you can get through pretty much anything. But in a short time, I think there are some concepts that just aren't going to work, unfortunately. So what you need to do in those cases is work out what part of the story you want to tell, or how you can get the person closer to understanding that story. You're taking them on a journey from where they are to here, maybe you're only going to be able to get them this far along the way, which isn't ideal, of course, but it might be better than nothing. It depends on what your goals are. If you really need people to understand this concept in its full explanation, its full detail, then probably you're going to have to find some format that allows you to capture their attention for long enough. So that might involve some really creative thinking on your part to do that. It might not just be speaking with someone. It might involve, maybe you can make a video with animations that'll make things clearer, or make a physical model of something and show it off. Things that you can't necessarily do so easily with just words face to face. So I think my short answer to this question is, if you don't have enough time, I think there are some concepts that are just too difficult to get across to a completely lay audience. And what you should do is think about your goals in that communication. Do you really need them to understand that, or do you just want to enthuse them about science and physics and the general field that you're working in?
I appreciated your comments about starting the conversation with your audience early, and start thinking early about whom you're communicating to, what you need, what that audience needs, and also starting the active conversation early, as in not just starting the conversation in your own head.
Yes.
So about that subject, I have two related questions. One concerns more the science communication interaction with the public sphere, and the other is sort of the analog within science. Mm-hmm. In the science communication sphere, if you have a great idea and you need feedback, you can, let's say you have a draft of a book, so you ask your best friend for feedback and a public librarian, all sorts of people. Mm-hmm. But there must be some trade-off between losing novelty and gaining good feedback. So how do you judge how much you're losing by losing that novelty? And on the other side, if you have a science blog and you are aware that scooping happens in science,
yeah,
then how do you balance your concerns?
Yeah. So these are both very good questions. With regard to the first one of novelty versus, what I find most useful is asking for explanations of why people give the answers they give. Continually asking, why do you think that, or why don't you like that? It's not very much use for someone to say, oh, that's really good, or that's really bad. It doesn't tell you much at all, so you need to probe a little deeper. Which means you need to have some honest and sometimes difficult conversations with people. And you need to find people who you can trust to give you honest answers and create an environment that's very welcoming of those answers, even if it's going to be tough for you to hear. But asking why more and more deeply, I think, is the key to getting that information. And then remembering that in the end, you still do make the judgment. You don't have to do everything that they want, because most people will tend to guide you toward what they're already familiar with. But if you can work out why they don't like something, then maybe you can find a different way around that problem. Okay, with regard to being scooped, this is a tough one, and I think it's evolving. I don't think we're quite ready for fully open notebook science at this point because of a couple of reasons. One is that there aren't good ways of claiming priority on ideas that are smaller than the size of a paper. I mean, posting to the archive will essentially be a claim of priority, whereas can you do that with some sort of draft or something smaller? There are services out there like Figshare, which I find interesting, which allow you to post pretty much any kind of content, and it's used primarily by scientists in a certain form, and you'll get a DOI for that piece of content, so you can reference it very easily. DOI is a document object identifier. Every paper has one, although you don't usually see it in the citation. On the website, it'll usually be there of the journal. So maybe services like that allow you to post something and it will archive it with a time and date stamp will be more useful for encouraging this kind of open research. I also wonder how much theft of ideas really goes on. I know people are very worried about it, but it seems to me that anyone who is doing much of this thieving is going to be found out pretty quickly, and their reputation will suffer for it. The community that you work in has many people, but it's not that big. And word gets around when people do these sorts of things. So I'm not so sure that thieving is as big a problem as we often worry about. But I haven't seen good data on it. That's the tricky thing. It's a situation where we're fearful of a hypothetical circumstance, but don't really know if it's going to happen.
I particularly like the examples that you gave. So I'm wondering, actually, what is your favorite example of scientific communication that worked really well on several scales, like on the scientific scale, but also for the general public?
Okay. It's a difficult one. There are so many things to think about. Let me say that something that I think has been incredibly useful in the past few years, so this isn't necessarily one project, but a type of project that's come about that I think has been particularly useful in recent years, are the citizen science projects that exist. So Galaxy Zoo and Foldit at Home and many of these projects, because they do a nice job of both entertaining people and explaining some science. Maybe it's not a great deal of science, but it's something, and it's explaining something. Maybe not the science content, but more about the science process. And it's a sort of category of project that I find pretty exciting and I think is being quite well implemented in many cases. I mean, other sorts of projects that you can do, I mean, I can tell you a project that I did with some colleagues that seemed to be very successful, and it was draw the universe in chalk. And we basically did this for middle school kids. And first we explained to them how a logarithmic scale works so that we could plot out on 100 meters of bitumen on a pathway a log scale that took us from here to the edge of the universe, basically. And then the kids all got cards that had images of astronomical objects, whether they might be planets close by or nebulae or even the cosmic microwave background radiation was illustrated as an image. And then the kids went out and drew these in chalk on the pathway. And so over time, started to understand something about the scale of the universe. The kids really loved this activity and found it really exciting and asked a lot of questions. They wanted to know more about the science and the objects that they were drawing. It wasn't just a matter of taking the picture and putting it down on the ground. And you know, a lot of kids asked whether they could actually see these objects. This is what telescopes are for, and how do we go about it? And so it inspired kids in a lot of ways. And that came about because just we were trying to think about some different ways of telling some stories about science and communicating some messages. And you know, we found that worked really well, and it was something that we hadn't seen done before. So the element of surprise and novelty worked in our favor as well at that time. So there are lots of projects that people do that seem to be quite effective for limited goals. I'd say there aren't too many projects that are trying to do really grand things that actually work all that well. But that shouldn't stop us trying.
To take your attention again, but I couldn't help but notice on the list of adjectives that were describing symmetry,
yes,
the last one on the list was credible.
Yes.
I'm sure that that's not a deliberate choice, but I'm just wondering, like, before that came stylistic and artistic and approachable. It seems like there's kind of a tension between those two things sometimes. Like, if you look at the websites of even very big and serious science institutes, you can only assume that, like, they think that being pretty is being unserious. Like, they're just really, really simple and brutal. Is that... I'm wondering if you could say something about that.
Yeah, sure. This is one of the trade-offs, and it's what makes it a wicked problem. You know, that there isn't just one solution. You don't know if the solution works necessarily ahead of time. You can judge its impact a little later on. I think there is a tension there, but I think when it comes to, say, the graphic design challenge that we have in that particular case, that there are solutions that allow you to do good graphic design that has just the right amount of visibility of form. So we're as close to the crystal goblet as we need to be to get the job done, but we want to still push just a little bit into this other direction of being artful and stylish, hopefully in a way that doesn't destroy credibility. And I think one of the ways that we go about doing that is by remembering that people don't always wear their professional hats. They're not using their professional brain at all times. Sometimes they're using their purely human brain, and they like things that look nice and read well and are clear to them. And so if you can communicate with people on the level of their human brain rather than their scientific brain, if they're different, then you can go a long way toward successfully melding these different seemingly conflicting adjectives and approaches.
If there's not any more questions, then we'll wrap things up here. I just want to say a really big thank you to David for coming and sharing this talk with us. We will make the slides available as well, so if you want to find out how to get the slides, just come and talk to either of us and we'll set that up for you. And if you have any other discussion or questions for David, you can always come see him afterwards. But thanks a lot for your time this afternoon, and thank you, David.
Thank you.